Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Yes, well, the election of Donald Trump in America as US president was accompanied by widespread accusations of Russian meddling in the election campaign. There are currently a number of high-level investigations into those accusations, the main one, of course, being led by Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller. Already, significant figures such as President Trump's campaign manager, Robert Manafort, and his lawyer, Michael Cohen, have been found guilty of a number of charges and face long jail terms. There is a wider issue. According to my next guest, democracies everywhere around the world are being gamed, not just the United States. Fringe hackers, billionaire elites with extreme views, and sovereign states themselves are indulging in wholesale undermining and influence peddling on the internet. They seek to distort facts, peddle misinformation, and cause widespread chaos and destruction. Why? Well, because they can, it seems. Can democracy survive the digital age is a question. In a world of dark ads, data mining, and relentless personal data collection, trolling and meme wars, is democracy itself hopelessly hacked? Martin Moore is director of the Centre for the Study of Media, Communication and Power and a senior research fellow at King's College London. His new book is titled Democracy Hacked, Political Turmoil and Information Warfare in the Digital Age. He joins us this evening. Martin, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, Philip. Thank you for having me.
Yes, well, good to have you on. There's some important questions in this book. I mean, some pretty big questions for all of us, I guess. Maybe we should start with one of the obvious. I mean, did the Russians swing the election for Donald Trump?
No. Well, I'm sorry, I shouldn't be so categorical. I mean, we're still learning about what the Russians did. We're still learning about the scale of what the Russians' interference was. I think that, you know, the Russians were only, I mean, we sort of focused enormously on the Russians, not surprisingly, perhaps, because it's a foreign state interfering in another state's elections. But there were many, many different people who were seeking to take advantage of the American elections domestically and from other countries. And actually, what won it for Trump, in my view, was not Trump, Russia. It wasn't any individual. It wasn't a collection of individuals. What won it for Trump was the transformation of the communication system. I don't think Trump could have won had it not been for Twitter, for Facebook, for the remarkable new means of influencing our communication and our politics that we've seen develop over the last decade or so.
Yeah, I'm not trying to be skeptical about it at all, because clearly things have changed, as the phrase goes. However, whether or not the system, because it's changed, has caused it to have greater influence, of course, is another matter. What is different about the current world than the old one? Because there've always been influencers and propagandists there for as long as we've had any kind of communication and media, haven't there? I mean, people get upset about the influence of Rupert Murdoch, for example, when he was controlling a large number of newspapers. And there have been similar examples in your country and also in the United States too, about concentrations of media owners and particular views being peddled in the media. What's different about today?
You're absolutely right. And I spent an awful lot of time looking at the role of propaganda communication back in the early 20th century. And obviously, the Cold War was characterized by propaganda from each side. I think what we've seen, though, I mean, democracy is inherently, as a political system, it relies enormously on communications. I mean, people have talked about elections being essentially communications campaigns. And what we've seen in the last 20 years is the shift in terms of where people get their information, where people get their news, where people discuss politics. Fundamental shift from an age of information scarcity, where that was really controlled by a pretty contained number of media organizations. Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right to point out that many of those were certainly not, you know, necessarily doing justice to democracy.
Many of them were pushing, you know, severely slanted views based on their own commercial interests or their own political interests. I mean,
absolutely. And I think what we need to recognize is that we're going through this huge period of transition. And I was trying to understand the way people are gaming and distorting the system. But equally, you know, I mean, I could have written a whole other book, which is around how we're hearing citizens' voices. We're seeing the emergence of absolutely justified challenges to the prevailing political system. We're seeing this democratization, if you like, of media. And so you have, and this is the way I think it's been for the last few years, you have this kind of yin and yang. You have, depending on whether you're a glass half full or glass half empty person, you can look at what the transformation at the moment and you can say, look, these fabulous things are happening to our politics. Or you can look at it and say, these terrible things happen to our politics. But what you can't, I don't think, say is there's not much happening in our politics. I think what we're seeing is a transformation of our politics, and a transformation of our politics, which, of course, there are substantive reasons why people are angry, why people are challenging their governments, why people in France now are kind of in protest on the streets. Mm. But the way in which they are people are participating, the way in which people are organizing, the way in which people are challenging the existing systems, I think that is different, and that cannot be disassociated from the way they're using digital tools, and especially the main platforms like Facebook and Google and Twitter.
Mm. I sometimes wonder whether, you know, the media itself is terribly guilty of this, of overblowing the influence of new platforms simply because of their novelty. That we think because someone's saying something on a new platform, it's somehow more influential than if they said it on an old platform. Do you think that's a fair criticism?
I think I think one should always be skeptical about overblown claims about, you know, the new thing is transforming everything. Mm. One of the reasons why I came to the conclusion I did, and I didn't start with a particular thesis. I started looking at what was happening. I mean, really, I was looking at initially at what was happening in Britain, particularly obviously around not just Brexit, but the 2015 election, and then the 2017 election. And then I was looking at what was happening in America, and then I started looking more broadly. And what was apparent was that the defining aspect of politics was becoming its unpredictability and its volatility. And you could see in places like the Philippines, in Brazil, across parts of Europe, that actually no one really understood why politics was changing so fast, and no one really could figure out why this unpredictability was happening. And for me, at least, the one consistent thing that I could find across these elections was that those who were benefiting most, those who were doing best out of the unpredictability of the new system, were those who were using some of these digital tools most effectively, and particularly Facebook and some of the social media tools. And that was apparent in the Philippines. It was apparent in India. It was apparent in Brazil. And that for me was indicative of the kind of the way in which these are transforming politics.
Are more people? Here's a question. Are more people involved in the media through the new platforms like Facebook, Twitter, the internet generally? Are more people involved in the media than were involved in the old media?
Hugely. I mean, sorry, I suppose...
Well,
why
do we say that, though? I mean, more people may get their news now from Facebook, but then again, people used to get their news from radio and television and newspapers.
Right,
are more people getting the new? Are more people reading more news on Facebook?
So there's two questions there, I suppose. One of which is, it is the case now that if I want to find out what's happening in Australia, I can as easily go online and look at Australian publications. I can look at Australian blogs. I can search for various topics being discussed in Australia and look at YouTube videos. In a way that I just simply couldn't 15 or 20 years ago. So the availability of information to me, and not only about mainstream media, the number of both kind of amateur and semi-professional and professional news sites has exploded. So that's partly because the opportunities for making money, for gaining an audience, have changed enormously. So Google has the AdSense program, which allows anyone to just take a little bit of code and stick it in their website, and then suddenly they're showing ads on their site that are supposed to be relevant to the content on their site. It's got about 14 million publishers on the AdSense network. Facebook has something called Instant Articles, where originally it was so that news organizations could start publishing directly into the Facebook platform, but then it opened it up to everyone, and many people took advantage. And so you know, in that sense, almost anyone can be, or at least, you know, aim to be a news organization publishing news articles within Facebook. And of course, Facebook has 2.2 billion active users, so potentially you have a remarkable audience. So I think you do have an explosion of new people and organizations creating news, creating videos, creating content, at the same time as you have, as we as individuals have massively, massively more to choose from. And we're using different ways in which to decide what to see and what to look at and what to...
One of the things that you discuss in your book is why all this is at the moment bad for our democracy. I'm just playing the devil's advocate again here, but some might say, well, look, hang on, this is all good because we've got more information now. I mean, more people are able to express their views more easily, and more and you say more people are consuming those views. So it ought to be a better place because, after all, people can reject what they want to reject and accept what they want to accept. In other words, we're a more informed democracy, are we or not?
Believe me, Philip, I think, you know, as I say, one can see this from a very positive or negative perspective. It's a bit like that. There's a Hieronymus Bosch painting. It's this triptych, which is got on one side. It's got this awful picture of hell, and in the middle, it's kind of got what we actually like, and on the right hand side, it's got heaven. And I think we have a horrible tendency to swing violently from heaven to hell in terms of, you know, the way we see the digital world. And look back about six or seven years, and people were saying that the platforms and the internet were inevitably a force for good. I don't know if you just think back to 2011 and what was happening in the Arab Spring and across a lot of authoritarian countries where people were using these platforms to challenge authoritarian governments, and Mark Zuckerberg was being lauded, and people were saying, you know, people were holding up literally holding up signs in Tahrir Square in Egypt saying, thank you, Facebook. Thank you for helping us to. And there was, you know, a lot of discussion around the degree to which these platforms were inherently democratizing.
Well, what do you think about that? I mean, because this was one of the kind of cliches of the Arab Spring, wasn't it? That Facebook and, you know, this was the first time in human history we were told that, you know, that a democratic platform like Facebook or Twitter had actually been used to overthrow governments and bring about social change. I mean, it all seemed a bit overblown to me at the time. What's your view about the role of Facebook and Twitter in that anyway?
I think people confuse causation and enabling. So I think absolutely Facebook did not cause the Egyptian revolution or indeed any of the revolutions across the Arab world and North Africa. What Facebook did do, and what some of the other platforms did do, is they enabled people, they gave people much broader ways in which to participate, and a kind of ladder of participation. So what you saw, for example, was someone would post a video of the police beating up a protester onto Facebook, and then people would watch the video first of all, then they would, then they might share it, they might comment on it, they might like it. So they were associating themselves with it. Then they might join a group which was protesting about, you know, police brutality against protesters. And then that group would say, let's come to a meetup. And then they would meet up. And then they would, from that meetup, gradually build up into a collective organization that ended up with this huge number of people in Tahrir Square. And that's what we saw over the course of weeks and months prior to kind of what happened in Egypt. And I think we see that in a lot of places. We see people kind of going up this ladder of participation from doing something relatively kind of limited, superficial to begin with, and then they gradually become more and more involved.
Look, maybe we should go back to the beginning too, because your book is fascinating on many levels. It's also fascinating because of the detail of what you have in terms of actual influences, and we'll talk about those. Can we go back a bit further? This is sort of pre-digital, really. For an example of the way that states have used propaganda, tell us this remarkable story of the Black Lake incident in Bohemia. I found this astonishing.
Well, this goes to what you said about you know, propaganda having happened for a long time before the internet, And one of the things that struck me about a lot of the reporting about Russia and its interference in the U.S. election was that, Russia and many states have been interfering in other elections for years.
They've always done it.
They've always done it. And one of the things that the Soviet Union did, and did really from its outset, was it used propaganda very strategically, in the sense that it set up a whole kind of a bureaucracy of propaganda. Mm. Not just within Russia, but it had a whole series of kind of satellite offices within Eastern Europe, within the kind of larger Soviet Empire, who were doing propaganda as their full-time job. I mean, they were in offices, they were producing fake news, they were putting out sort of false reports. And at the time, it was really hard to get this stuff out, mainly because most media was national. Media was, as I say, quite constrained. So if you wanted to get it into a newspaper in Britain, you had to get it really into one of the 9 dailies, and that was hard. And they tried lots and lots of different avenues, and they tried to kind of gain support within the UK, etc., within the unions and stuff. But one of the operations, they used to plan these operations in great detail. One of the operations I describe in the book is where the Czech satellite office of the Soviet Union's propaganda bureaucracy set up a huge, sort of a very, very carefully constructed operation where they actually dropped black boxes into a lake, the Black Lake, and then participated in the production of a television program about the Black Lake, nothing to do with the boxes. And the boxes was done entirely covertly. And then as part of the program, they discovered, and I say that kind of in inverted commas because they knew they were there, they discovered these black boxes, opened them up, only to find that they were full of, they were full of black papers. But once they had swapped the papers, they said that they were full of papers revealing all these secrets about Germany during the Second World War and how Germany had behaved. And it reignited lots of the concerns about Nazi Germany just at the moment at which West Germany was trying to reintegrate to the international system, was trying to get over some of the legacy of the Second World War, and created significant divisions within Europe and elsewhere. But yet the whole thing was a hoax. The whole thing was entirely created for the purposes of propaganda. Very successful.
So the whole documentary, the subsequent news reports, the story that ran for months, was all just made up by the Russians.
It was all made up. Yeah. It was all made up. Yeah. I mean, and that was one example of many. So I mean,
secret, Nazi documents discovered. No, there weren't.
Exactly.
There were no
exactly.
Nazi documents.
There were no Nazi documents. They were entirely, they got some real Nazi documents from which they'd kind of taken back to Russia during the Second World War, which didn't say what they said they said, but were convincing enough and material enough that they could show them at press conferences and say, look at these.
By the way, do the Americans or the British, for that matter, disrupt the governments of Russia or the Middle East or anywhere else? I presume they do, don't they?
Oh, my goodness. where do you start?
I mean, if they're doing it to us, presumably we're doing it to them, aren't we?
Well, one of the things that's striking when you start to read about what Russia has been doing in the last 20 years is how it always puts it, and you know, this is obviously slightly self-interested, but it always puts it in a defensive frame. So it always talks about how it's responding. It's not initiating this. It's responding to the activities of other countries, particularly of the U.S. And the U.S. for years, the U.S. has interfered either its government's interfered or it's interfered commercially in other people's elections. I mean, perhaps from kind of Putin's perspective, one of the most egregious was in 1996, where American consultants worked very closely with Yeltsin, who at the time was really quite unwell and looked as though he was not going to win, to try and help him to win the election in 1996. And you have this cover of Time magazine after the election, which has a picture of a kind of a happy Yeltsin saying "Yanks to the rescue," claiming, I think false, but claiming credit for Yeltsin's election, claiming credit for American consultants and American influence. So yes, I mean, I think there is a long history of countries involving themselves in other people's elections. I think one of the reasons why we've got so concerned about, or the Americans have got so concerned about 2016, is because of their belief, and whether it's true or not, it's certainly the belief that many of them have, that Russia was a lot more successful in 2016 than it had been previously. So as a consequence, they've been...
All right, it's not just tit for tat, as your book sort of sets out, and you say that there are much more fundamental issues here. We're talking with Martin Moore. His book, Democracy Hacked, Political Turmoil and Information Warfare in the Digital Age, talks about a new world we have entered since the mid-2000s. This new world is dominated by the big tech companies, Google in particular, and its parent company Alphabet, Twitter, and Facebook, the great elephant in the room, and that the internet generally too, for that matter, is being used for all kinds of purposes for which it was never intended. Can we go back? You might like to join this conversation, or if you've got a question, 1-300-800-222 is the number. There are lines free, 1-300-800-222. Text on 0467-922-702.
On ABC Radio, it's Nightlife with Philip Clark.
Martin, can we go back to the, well, not the beginning, but, well, the beginning of hacking, because it's not that old, actually. You say there are three kinds of hackers. There's individual extremists. There are state hackers. And then there are the plutocratic hackers, that is, billionaire individuals who've got a bee in their bonnet. The extremists started with the premises the internet ought to be free. This is how the internet sort of began. And they've done their level best to try and make sure that no one can control them. Have they succeeded?
Well, I guess what I tried to do was to think about hacking, and to think about particularly election hacking, in terms of models. So how are people hacking, and how are they doing it successfully? And I think I talk about three different models. One's individuals, one's plutocrats, or very rich individuals, and the other is states. Mm. And in the case of individuals, the most successful kind of individuals at distorting election process, I think, were those on the right in 2016. And when I was trying to, the thing that really fascinated me was that a lot of them, and these were people coming out of sites like 4chan and some subreddit groups and 8chan and elsewhere, they didn't look, when you looked at their behavior and looked at what they talked about, you looked at their history, they didn't look like they cared about traditional politics at all. In fact, quite the opposite. They thought that traditional politics was, you know, was for normies. They wanted to have nothing to do with it. So I kind of started from a perspective of thinking, well, how on earth did this incredibly disparate, dispersed group ever come to get involved in a traditional election campaign? And when I traced it back and tried to figure out what it was that motivated them, there were two ideologies, I guess you could call them, which really seemed to me to be the only two ideologies that held this incredibly disparate group together. And one was a sort of a fundamentalist view about free speech, that nothing should constrain people's freedom to speak and to express themselves. Mm. The second was what I call sovereignty, which was essentially a belief that in this space, in this online space, whether that's 4chan, whether it's Reddit, whether it's, you know, whatever space it is that they inhabit, they're sovereign, that they should be able to make the rules in that space, that they should be able to govern that space, however lawlessly or otherwise they would like to do. And if governments or kind of real world meat space organizations try to interfere in that online community or space that they created, that was almost like an act of warfare. You know, that was a transgression they could not forgive. And it was those two specific ideologies that I think were the reason why they came together during the course of the sort of 2016 U.S. campaign. Partly because they were convinced, whether rightly or wrongly, they were convinced by people like Steve Bannon and Breitbart that should Hillary Clinton get elected, she would seek to take away their sovereignty and she would seek to constrain their freedom.
Hmm. All right, let's take a caller to Frank. Hello.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I was wondering how when we think about what the Russians have done in the American election in 2016 and Brexit or whatever, mm-hmm. and the Chinese large-scale IP theft, I wonder how many people in the West can see any connection between that and the Snowden revelations around 2013, because there is a very strong connection, because those revelations showed us how the Americans were using their dominance as the world's greatest power in computer technology and software. They were using that to achieve a lot of intelligence and espionage dominance. And if I was to look at this from a Russian point of view, I would say what the Russians did in, for example, the 2016 election, was getting back at the Americans for what the kinds of programs that were revealed by Snowden.
Hmm.
And the irony is, of course, that these social media platforms, which are definitely undermining democracy, they're being used against the Americans. Their own platforms are being used against them.
Yes. Yeah, it's an interesting point, isn't it, Martin? Frank's right, isn't he, when the Snowden revelations did show just that.
I think Frank has made a very perceptive point. I mean, I think that, and one can even look slightly before the Snowden revelations, because in 2011, when I mentioned about the Arab Spring, one of the things that that Hillary Clinton's State Department were doing at the time was sort of suggesting that some of the tools that have been used during the Arab Spring could be used to undermine other governments. And Putin actually took this as a kind of message directed to him. In fact, you know, Hillary Clinton was famously very, very critical of Putin and his government. And if you remember, at the end of 2011, there were these huge demonstrations in Russia. At the time, you know, Medvedev was in charge, but Putin kind of essentially in charge. And Putin became very anxious that this was a prelude to being Medvedev being deposed. And so you see from kind of 2012 onwards, and particularly, as you say, after the Snowden revelations, a massive shift in focus by Russia to seek to control the internet, and particularly the Russian internet. So previous to that, you know, sites like Yandex, which is their equivalent of Google, and VKontakte, which is their version of Facebook, had been relatively independent, and the government started to move in and to take much more control. And there's a fascinating speech was given by General Gerasimov, who was a general in Russia in 2013, and he talks about how Russia needs to move towards a much more a hybrid form of warfare, and a hybrid form of warfare that includes seeing the internet and the information arena as part and parcel of the new 21st century warfare.
Very much so. Craig, hello. Thanks, Frank. There were interesting points. Craig, hello.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Not bad.
That's the way. Mine was more of a comment, I guess, but I just found it to be a delicious irony that America, who has been so hell-bent on regime change around the world under the guise of, you know, spreading democracy, that they now, you know, cry out that this has been some heinous crime against their free speech and stuff. It's just amazing. And as I said to the gent who answered the phone or picked up, this is the first time, seriously, that I have heard anyone say that the US and British and whoever else has been doing this, and it's just a delicious irony to me.
Mm. Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I don't know. Is the Australian government trying to interfere in Indonesian affairs? We know they are. Well, I don't know whether they're doing it on social media platforms, but we know they're doing it in other ways. In other words, Martin, all governments are doing it at all times. Is that fair?
Well, it's, so as I kind of talk about in the book, I think you're certainly right. The governments have for a long time sought to influence other people's politics, and will continue to. In the U.S., particularly in the 20th century, partly, you know, justified, they said, by the Cold War, was constantly trying to influence and interfere in other people's elections. I think the difference now is that, for one thing, it's so much easier. I mean, you know, that I talked about some of the techniques that the Russians were trying to use in the 60s and 70s and 80s. Now, those techniques would normally fail, and if they didn't fail, they would take years to happen. Mm. Now, those techniques can be done, you know, in real time. You can, you know, what the Internet Research Agency was doing out of St. Petersburg was being done, you know, during the course of the U.S. election, and it was being, you know, the ads that they were paying for, and the messages that they were targeting were being targeted during the course of, you know, the months leading up to that election, which just would not have been possible a few decades ago.
One of the interesting things out of your book, and in fact we've discussed it here on the program in the past too, is that in a sense much of all this has occurred kind of by accident, in this sense that Facebook, of course, started out, you know, we've often remarked this in the past, no one ever asked anybody to invent a system where people could contact each other over the internet. But anyway, Mark Zuckerberg did. But what started out as a kind of check up with your friends, find missing people, you know, generally have a bit of a neighbourhood hoo-ha sort of online vehicle, has morphed into what's called now Facebook, which is a means of selling highly targeted advertising. And Facebook, it's no longer a communication platform. It's a seller and targeter of highly targeted advertising. That's what it is. And the tools that have been developed to use Facebook in that way are the tools that have been used and misused, you say in your book, by all sorts of people to target messages in a way that's unknown in history because of the size and scale of the messages that can be targeted at people, messages of all kinds. So in other words, I mean, there hasn't been a conscious design to do this, but people have jumped onto and made use of a technology almost by accident.
Well, that's certainly right. You're absolutely right that they didn't. The last thing they thought they would become is this sort of the political means of choice for almost any campaign in the world when they're trying to run a campaign. What's happened generally is Facebook will introduce a new tool or a new advertising method designed to help businesses, and they work very closely obviously with lots of businesses, and they're trying to help businesses to advertise more effectively to their customers, and then very quickly that tool will be adopted by a political campaigner or a party or a candidate and used for a political purpose. And we saw that especially since 2012, because what happened in 2012 was that Facebook went public, and up to that point they had been focused almost entirely on just growing the number of users, and they'd grown them amazingly. And by 2012 they had a billion users, but they hadn't thought that carefully about how they were going to make money off their users. But it was only really in 2012, when they were going public, when they had to justify their valuation, their very high valuation, to shareholders, and they had to show shareholders how they were going to grow and grow revenue. They started developing much more sophisticated targeting tools, like custom audiences and lookalike audiences, and these other sorts of tools, which, as I say, became, and in fact, dark ads they introduced in 2013, which then became first used by businesses, but within kind of 1 or 2 years were being used broadly by campaigns to really, I think.
These are ads which are targeted at very specific people. And in fact, if you open up your Facebook site, unless you're being targeted, you don't see them.
Exactly. So.
I mean, it's kind of spooky, isn't it? Really,
it completely splinters the idea of a public sphere because you know, your next door neighbor may be receiving a completely different message
on his Facebook feed, maybe reading things. You might have the same general news feed open, but he's getting very specific messages about you know, voting for a particular cause, whereas you're getting quite the opposite messages.
Exactly, and that's deliberate too, because the thing that's, I think, really different about the methods that campaigns now have is that they can see how people respond. So they know They know if you've looked at their message. They know if you've liked it, if you shared it, if you commented on it. And based on your response, they'll then evolve the message. So generally, you know, what the Trump campaign was really innovative was in using Facebook in a it's almost like a Darwinistic evolution. They would take an ad and they would put out hundreds and indeed thousands of different versions of it, and then they would see which one was effective, and then they would use that one and dump the other one, and then they would, you know, swap that against and keep comparing until they found out the most effective ad for a particular type of audience, and then they would keep showing that ad to that type of audience. And so it's sort of learning from our vulnerabilities.
Not that there's anything wrong with that, I suppose, because after all, political parties have been doing that since time immemorial, trying to find the right message. All right, 1-300-800-222 is the text, is the number if you'd like to call. The Reliance free, 1-300-800-222. Text on 0467922702. Lines free if you want to grab one. 1-300-800-222. We're talking with Martin Moore, and his book, Democracy Hacked, describes what he says is a very profound change in the way that democracy is now conducted and the peril it is in as a result of the gaming of the wider internet. So if you'd like to comment or question, 1-300-800-222 is the number.
This is Nightlife with Philip Clark on ABC Radio.
We are one.
I am very much a city girl and a word nerd. I love ABC podcasts because I can just scroll through what's available and always find something that resonates with me. It is crucial to me that there's stories coming out from all walks of Australian life, and I have always loved the ABC for that reason, and I'll continue to. I'm Emily, and that's my story.
Share your stories at abc.net.au/yours.
You're with Philip Clark on ABC Radio. It's Nightlife.
Yes, indeed it is. Pippa, hello.
Oh, good evening, and welcome. I'm not...
Martin it is.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, Martin. I'm not sure whether you're aware, but here in Australia, we've got issues re-influencing our best and most famous ABC politically. Now, we're getting over that bump, thank God, but that influence we don't like in Australia because we're highly... Not just critical of our politicians, but we also have a wonderful feeling of mistrust. Now, we noticed after the Cambridge Analytica problems came up in BBC, well, you know, brought here by the BBC, then we noticed the rubles payment after the American elections. We're all very much aware of that mistrust that it's brought up. Australian. Our parliament is trying to legislate so that the rules will basically suit our nation more than anyone else. How do you think that will stop those nefarious influences in our political system?
It's a good question. In fact, I suppose, in a sense, Martin, we should move to the next phase of the conversation, which is, what do we do about all of this? You say there are three basic options, really. There, you know, we either become a democracy, which is, you know, a democracy of platforms, of Facebook or Google or whatever. We end up like the big states of China and Russia, which try and control the internet, or we do something else. What's your view?
Well, I think I think that Australia is doing. I was just reading today, actually, the Australian Commission looking at the power of these platforms, and I think Australia is clearly thinking very carefully about this. I think the problem that Australia has, that we all have, is that these platforms are so big now and they're so transnational that it's very hard to see what one nation can do without working in collaboration with others. And I think a lot of people are floundering about how to respond. And that's one of the reasons I sort of set out these alternative futures, partly because two of them I'm not very keen on at all. I mean, you mentioned the platform democracy and the surveillance democracy, and both of those, it seems to me, is a futures we'd really rather not go in, because one of them puts a huge amount of power in the hands of these great big platforms.
Platform democracy is basically that we're run by Google, well, and Facebook.
certainly all our public services, and that's what's happening in some countries in the US and elsewhere when it comes to things like health and education and transport. And surveillance democracy is most obviously in China, but actually we're seeing the export of that, and certainly the export of certain aspects of that to other countries in Asia. There's this amazing program in India called Aadhaar, which is this massive biometric identification program that they've run in India over the last decade. So the third option, it seems to me, the more I kind of thought about the scale of change we're going through, the more I realized that if we just see this in terms of how do we regulate the platforms, or how do we sort out an individual problem like fake news or something else, then we'll miss the big picture. And the big picture seems to me that actually we need to rethink the way we do democracy, because the tools, what the tools now allow us to do, is so far beyond what conventional politics allows us to do, that gap, I think, is creating lots of volatility, lots of anxiety, and lots of people going around the system, sometimes for very kind of benign and positive ends, sometimes for malign ones. And so I think we have to, as I say, rehack democracy, it seems to me, if we're going to find our way out of this this problem.
Yes, because one of the things you say is that it's when people say, well, why doesn't the government do more to control, say, extremist ads on Facebook, etc., you say this is probably one of the worst ways to go in a way, because if we say it's all just about controlling these platforms, we are in essence ceding authority to these platforms and saying, well, you know, the main business of democratic life is conducted on these platforms. And you're saying that's not a good way to go.
Well, certainly as more and more of our lives is filtered through the platforms, and not just our kind of consumption of news and our communication with each other, but our access to healthcare and to education, then potentially, if we're not careful, those platforms gain enormous amounts of control. And if we go kind of the direction of saying, well, okay, let's get the government to start to regulate them and to tell them what to do, then potentially you have an even worse situation where the kind of big platforms and governments collaborate together to create this slightly Orwellian world where we're all under surveillance all the time.
So what do we do?
So as I say, I think we need to. The first thing we need to do, I think, is acknowledge the scale of the change that we're going through, because I think it is a fundamental change. I mean, there's a writer, Robert McChesney, who talks about it being the fourth great transformation of communication. The first being the invention of language, the second the invention of writing, the third the invention of printing, and this is the fourth. And each of the previous ones was followed by lots of political and social ructions. And so I think we have to recognise that the scale of what we're going through, and then. What I'd love to see, and I haven't seen it in this country, and I don't know whether you have in Australia, but is I'd love to see more of a vision as to where we want to be in 10, 15, 20 years' time, in the sense that, you know, do we want to be countries that are dominated by, where the whole public sphere is dominated by a kind of a handful of mostly American technology platforms? Do we want to be countries where, you know, we have ownership of our own data? Do we want to be countries where we have very strict rules around sort of what people are and aren't allowed to share in terms of privacy, or the opposite? So, but at the moment, it seems to me as though we kind of keep being like a whack-a-mole. We keep seeing a problem, which has emerged partly as a consequence of this transformation, and we say, quick, we have to deal with that problem. It's harassment, it's bullying, it's fake news, it's election interference. And if we keep doing that, we'll endlessly just find ourselves kind of rushing around trying to deal with the last problem.
The chief executives of Google, or their parent company Alphabet, were recently reported as saying that they believe that the internet as a global phenomenon is dead, in the sense that there'll be a number of different internets. In fact, maybe there already are. That China, for example, doesn't have a free and open internet. That in the future, what we might see is an American internet, a European internet, a Chinese internet, and I don't know, for that matter, you might see an Iranian one too. You might see the proliferation of it. As states do what you're saying and try to actually put limits on what these technology platforms can do. In other words, the the once utopian goal of a free, open and accessible internet to everybody on the planet is probably not going to happen anymore. What do you think about that?
Well, I think you're certainly right that, and it makes me very anxious too, that a lot of states are trying to figure out how to essentially nationalize the internet.
That's
and
right.
You mentioned Iran, and Iran has done exactly that. It's since 2011-12, it has created a national internet, it started with about 500-600 sites, all of which have been pre-approved by the government. You can still get access to many sites beyond Iran, but they are slower, they're much more expensive to access, and there are many more limitations put on those sites. So it's much easier to access the sites domestically. But of course, the sites domestically are controlled and essentially licensed by the government. So that's the way in which some authoritarian governments are going. The Russian government has been going in a similar direction. China, of course, is way ahead on this.
Well, China's already there, aren't they? Yeah.
Well, China's already, but it's going further. I mean, the social credit system, if it's sort of brought in nationally by the government in 2020, will be a kind of a huge step in the surveillance direction.
Mm.
So I think, you know, but at the same time, you know, many states are looking at these transnational companies and saying we have to do something about the fact that we don't seem to have any leverage. We don't seem to be able to kind of tell these companies what to do or kind of intervene or direct them. And so they are scrambling around looking for ways to do that. And one of the ways to do that is potentially to follow this path of kind of trying to nationalize the net. But as I say, that's the path taken by many authoritarian governments, and it's one that makes me pretty anxious.
Macca says, does anyone take any notice of adverts on Facebook? I don't. yes, Macca, I know, but it's a bit more than that in a way too, isn't it? Digby, hello.
Hey, we're on in agriculture. And one of the big challenges that we're facing is trying to get confidence in our politicians that they will actually listen to fact, the emotional credit card opening feedback that they get from Facebook and Twitter and the like. We get animal welfare legislation, health acts, which is done not on the basis of how many clicks they got. And we're the rolling the same deal. I'm harvesting GM cholera as we talk.
Sure, I might just I get the point you're making, Digby. I might just put you back on hold, so the line's a bit dodgy. But that's not a bad point that Digby makes, isn't it, Martin? That the trouble is politicians may find this whole new world irresistible to them, because after all, it means that they're in there influencing as well.
Absolutely, and I think there's two issues with the I think actually. And again, I can't speak for Australian politicians, but certainly the politicians in this country and many of those I've seen around Europe, I think generationally there's a problem. I think generationally many of them, you know, are not very familiar with these tools, and they really just see them as a way in which to sort of promote themselves and promote some of their goals. But equally, it's one of the things that struck me when I was doing this book was how strange it is that we've come to rely almost entirely on these on particular online platforms as our new public sphere, not least because the kind of ways in which they elevate certain content over other content, they show us certain things rather than other things, is not really, it doesn't align with many of the democratic values that we have. It's very much around their own particular purposes, much of which are around kind of generating advertising and engagement. And so we've got this kind of weird system where we are being encouraged to judge the importance of something or someone, the kind of authoritative nature of a statement by their criteria, and often their criteria are just a numbers game.
Sure.
You know, it's just number of retweets or number of shares or number of likes.
Exactly right. Francis, hello.
Oh, hi there. How are you?
Oh, well.
Good. Interested in the intersection of the Orwellian society and the cashless society.
Oh, yeah.
Where we start to create these incredibly intense and deep databases of literally everything we do. Every dollar we spend, every action we take, it's going to be in a database somewhere. So even more intense than even Facebook is our spending patterns, and they're going to be actually recorded from now on.
Well, they'll be intimately recorded, actually, with extraordinary levels of data accuracy, won't they, Martin? That's true.
That's absolutely true, and that's one of the reasons why the social credit system in China has been so successful, because so many people in China, many more than in America, use their phones as their payment cards, and it's all integrated with the Alibaba platform, and then the Alibaba platform runs the social credit system. So the whole thing is integrated. And as you say, I think this takes us into a world in which potentially either the platforms or the governments or both know almost everything we're doing at any time of the day, and with whom. And that's the kind of world I think we have to be very conscious.
What do you do personally, Martin? Are you a signed up contributor to Facebook and Twitter and all these platforms?
Well, I feel like I have to be on a lot of these platforms.
Because some might say, well, why are you doing it? Like, you should go off grid.
Well, I mean, I do it because I need to understand it. I do it because I need to be part of it. In fact, actually, I sometimes feel very strange. I mean, like on Snapchat, you know, that's clearly not my generation. No. I do it for the work.
Interesting. It's a very, very interesting book and interesting debate. And I think you are right. We are just, it's dawning on us that we are actually at a very, very critical point in our history. Martin Moore, thank you for your time. I appreciate your time very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. Dr. Martin Moore is Director of the Centre for the Study of Media, Communication and Power at King's College in London.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.